Oregon faces and the overarching sense of our tax system and how it works. Also, we have Dave Hunt, a former Speaker of the House. He was Speaker in 2009, during the first time since I was in the legislature that we actually had a supermajority in both houses and among the Democrats. He was instrumental that year, working with a very small group, four of us, in getting the bills passed that ended up becoming Measures 66 and 67, which restored the top Oregon tax rate for individuals to very close to 10%, where it was in the 1980s, and also established a new minimum tax, or an increased minimum tax for corporations, and changed the corporate rate to try to get us a little closer to a fair tax system. And he's going to talk about that and a couple of other issues today. I will bat clean up, and then we'll go to questions. So they get 5 minutes each, and I get an hour and a half, and we'll go from there. Thanks a lot. Vicki, first.
Thank you. Is it best if I just stand right here? I think I'm comfortable with this, and I was struck by our introduction here saying that this was going to be a really interesting panel. We're not used to talking taxes and have people have it be interesting to them. So I'm admiring right off the bat. This group, and particularly Phil and I, are known to be real drudges within the legislature. Nobody really wanted to talk to us. I came into the legislature in 2003. I served 12 years, and I was on the Revenue Committee that entire time. It's called the Revenue Committee because being on the Tax Committee is sort of toxic if you're a politician, and so that's why it really is called the Revenue Committee, and it is. It's the incoming piece as opposed to the Ways and Means. What I wanted to do for you today is sort of set the stage and describe our tax system. Now, I don't want to offend anybody. There's people in this room who understand this probably as well as Phil and I, but there's a lot of the public who doesn't understand what's unique about Oregon's tax system, and so that's the stage I'd like to set for you. The kind of, and I'm trying to avoid numbers as much as possible around here, but the sort of visual that everybody talks about tax systems at the statewide level is this three-legged stool, which is property taxes, income taxes, and sales taxes. Yes, there are lots of other taxes, but you can throw them into those kind of buckets, if you like, and if the stool is, if all three legs are pretty equal, it's considered a pretty basic and pretty firm foundation of taxes for a public entity. Well, of course, nobody has that exact configuration, and what's unique about Oregon is we are so far off of that configuration that we're just almost unique. In terms of per capita taxes, we're right in the middle of the 50 states. We're like 25th. So you'd say, oh, well, we're right in the middle. But in terms of those three types of taxes, we are just crazy off the charts. Of course, we have no general sales tax, and everybody gets that. So take that leg off the stool and forget it. So that stool's not balanced no matter what. Our property tax system, this is a group that probably remembers in the 90s, we put constraints on our property tax system. And we did it, I like to say this is one of my least popular California imports. We did it in response to property tax sort of fights that were going on south of us, and we did, quite frankly, a terrible job. It's 20, 25 years down the road, and it's coming home to roost. Here's what's wrong with what we did. We put numeric constraints, not indexed constraints. So as we grow, you can't change those numbers. It's in the Constitution. So, like, we can't kind of fix it a little bit along the way. And over the 20 years, it's gotten kind of wacko in terms of who pays and the various values under our property tax system. At a statewide level, the impact is mostly felt in the fact that the other provision of it is the state then took over funding for K-12 education above the property tax sort of threshold. So all of a sudden, where the state was not the biggest player in education funding, it became the biggest player in education funding. And that was the statewide impact. I will tell you, your local governments are really hurting now because of the constraints of the property tax limitations that were put on. They are the ones who are most seriously impacted, not the state. So I don't want to get into it in a big way, except to say that you need to know this is not, it's a constrained system. That's how I would describe it. So what we are dependent on in this state, and we are number two in terms of rate, is personal income. That is by far the biggest source, and it's way off the charts in terms of its impact into our tax system. We are the state of income taxes. And it's a good thing if having a progressive system is something that is really desirable to you, because there is no question, if you live in Oregon, the rich pay more and the poor pay less. And if that's your goal, then we're pretty far there compared to a lot of other states. The huge downside of Oregon's tax system is its volatility. It just fluctuates wildly. And in a global economy, I mean, when we were a little state with a natural resource base and a little plywood or mill in every small town, we had a really stable system. But that's not the world we live in now. And so our dependence on this single source of taxes, we can be, I mean, the dot-com bubble, did that have anything to do with what was going on in Oregon? No, but it completely whacked us. The Great Recession, again, we didn't do that. We had a run-up, but so we are at the mercy of forces that we in Oregon cannot control when our tax system is so volatile. I think of it as a balloon, and we have been in a period where the balloon is growing, and it really looks good because people are employed, things are going great, this balloon is growing. But it is like a balloon, one pinprick, and it collapses on us, and we are left reeling when you're trying to sustain a programmatic state government. So that, in essence, is sort of the way we are configured. And we are very unusual in that, and we are equally unusual in that we're the opposite of our neighbor to the north, who have no income tax, but they have huge sales tax that they're dependent on. So we've kind of got this contrast between the two states. California is a little more balanced in terms of theirs, and there's various configurations throughout the 50 states. But ours is unusual. One other point I want to make, because I always make this when I get in front of a group. Well, if you're so dependent on up and down, why don't we have a rainy day fund? Well, we do. And people are not very aware of it. We started it in 2003, and it has automatic triggers that feed it. And I actually checked with the revenue office to see what it is. And at the end of this biennium, there's actually two funds. One is dedicated to education, and the other is general fund, rainy day. And combined at the end of this biennium, there'll be about $1 billion in those two funds, a little over $1 billion, which is significant because I don't think there's anybody here who doesn't know that this bubble we're in won't last forever. And they never do, this expansion. And this state is facing some significant problems, and our tax system has to work for us. That's the point of a tax system. So I'll leave it at that as that overview, and welcome your questions about what the options are. In the meantime, Dave can talk about what is sort of more immediate in front of us and some of the other issues that we didn't even start on. So thanks.
Pleasure to be with my two colleagues. It's always fun to be back in Lane County. My wife and I grew up. I'm a Sheldon grad. She's a Springfield grad, so it's always nice to be here. And my mother-in-law, Sherry Moore, serves on the Springfield City Council, so I have some continuing deep roots in Lane County. You know, I think it's interesting. One thing I had not realized until I was sitting here, all three of us started off as school board members before we were legislators. And that is significant because a lot of the reason we ran for the legislature was deep frustration with being school board members and not having any tools to be able to do anything about these perpetual post-Measure 5 cuts. So in addition to some of the challenges that Vicky talked about, we also have a challenge within that imbalance of really low corporate taxes. Part of that is related to not having a sales tax. Part of that is just related to rates for corporations. And so that's, within the imbalance of being heavily dependent on non-sales taxes, we also have this imbalance of having really low corporate tax. In fact, last I looked, corporations are paying a little less than 7%, which is now less than we get from the Oregon lottery. So the lottery tax on, people with gambling addiction, poor people, people who don't know math, that is actually crazily bringing in more revenue than corporate tax in Oregon right now. We also have the tax kicker. Now, the kicker law was passed way back in 1980. It was put in the Constitution in 2000. But if you think about that cyclical nature that Vicky talked about, and combine that with when times are up, we take all this additional revenue that's coming in because people are earning more income, because businesses are expanding faster, because more people are moving to Oregon, and we put it into a rainy day fund. No, we don't. We send it out in tax, what used to be tax kicker checks, now tax kicker credits on your taxes. So if we could just take that money and put it into a rainy day fund, all those hills and valleys that we're in right now would be dramatically changed. So although we have a good size rainy day fund, as Vicky said, which was not true, Vicky and I were classmates in 2003, that recession that we all had to deal with as legislators, if we had had the kind of rainy day fund now that we had then, that would have ameliorated a lot of that. Now, in the Great Recession, it would have needed to be larger, but it is a good start. We just need to build on it. We also have a challenge of supermajority requirements. Supermajority requirements to raise any new revenue, whether it is, we've been through great discussions around transportation taxes, around cigarette taxes. Any modest tax increase has to have a supermajority vote. So we've tied our hands, voters or legislators in the past have tied our hands in a variety of ways, created a really challenging situation. But a few positive signs of things that we have been able to do and looking ahead, I think, opportunities. One of my favorite ones to talk about is double majority reform. Because one of the many bad legacies Bill Sizemore left us with was the requirement that it took school districts or local governments a double majority to pass any measures. So we had examples in North Clackamas, Gladstone, and Oregon City in my district where voters said, yes, we want a bond, but 49% of the people turned out, so it failed. And it took a whole bunch of years, but we did, and I give Vicky a lot of credit for withstanding. We can get into some interesting stories during Q&A, but withstanding a lot of pressure from her caucus to stick on that bill. And actually, Pat Farr from Eugene was also part of that effort. We actually convened a hearing that was not really a hearing when Speaker Minnis prevented us from having a hearing on double majority reform. But the positive sign of that is, despite the fact that it was put in the Constitution, the legislature referred out and voters passed a constitutional change in 2008 to pull that out of the Constitution. So now local voters, when they pass something, it actually passes. It doesn't matter if 49% of the people vote or 83% of the people vote. As long as a majority vote, yes, it passes. As Phil mentioned, 66 and 67, I think, are a positive sign that voters are willing to do something related to new revenue. It's got to be the right thing. And clearly, if you ask voters, they want the state to invest more in early childhood, in K-12, in community colleges and universities, and in other public services. So it's not like the public is saying, yeah, our class sizes are fine, the length of the school year is fine, college tuition is fine. Voters get it that we need investment. And so with the right kind of investments, I think we can get there. So let me suggest four things looking ahead that I think are benchmarks in my mind for success around revenue. One is only focusing on things that can actually get both a 3/5 vote in the legislature as well as a majority of voters. If you just get one and not the other, it doesn't matter. We've all been through, in fact, during Vicky and my first term, the longest session in Oregon history. We all love that, right, Phil? We ultimately came to a revenue package that the legislature passed, but then voters annihilated. So it doesn't matter if the legislature passes something if voters are not willing to sustain it. So that can be a difficult challenge to navigate, but the only way to get to new revenue is to have something that you can get a three-fifths vote in the House, a three-fifths vote in the Senate, a governor's signature, and then that will be sustained by voters when it's inevitably put on the ballot by through the referendum process. Secondly, focus only on taxes that are really possible. If you look at public opinion polling, it's been amazingly consistent over the last 15 years at least. Oregonians do not want a sales tax. Oregonians believe that personal income taxes are either adequate or too high. Oregonians believe that property taxes are adequate or too high. Oregonians believe that small business taxes are adequate or too high. But a majority of Oregonians, in poll after poll after poll, believe that large businesses and corporations should be paying more in taxes. So there aren't 20 options on the table, but there are some on the table. Did I mention that Oregonians do not want a sales tax? I just want to make sure you heard that, because it doesn't matter how you ask the question, and lots of governors and legislators have tried sales taxes by themselves, sales taxes dedicated to certain things, sales taxes traded off for cutting other taxes. That I have yet to see a proposal that can get even more than 35% of voters. But there are multiple options still within increasing corporate taxes, I think, that will generate new revenue. Third, new revenue's got to be dedicated to specific purposes. Oregonians do not trust probably any institutions. This is true of Americans right now, and it's probably getting worse. There is distrust of the state. There's distrust of local governments. There's distrust of churches and charities and other institutions. So any revenue has got to be explicitly dedicated to something specific. The education spectrum is probably the most politically popular and greatly needed, but it's got to be dedicated. And fourth, I think we've also got to commit to boosting the rainy day fund that Vicky talked about. One way to do that is through redirecting the personal kicker into a rainy day fund that can only be used with supermajority votes. And you won't hear any of us, well, maybe Vicky, but you won't hear probably any of us encourage supermajority votes on things. But I actually think tapping the rainy day fund is maybe the only supermajority vote I would ever favor, because I actually think it's a good thing. You lock those dollars into a rainy day fund, and it requires a supermajority vote to trigger it during the next recession. So I think we can get there, but I think those are four guidelines that it's going to take in order to do so for new revenue.
Thanks, Vicky and Dave. I think those are great summaries of where we sit. I want to talk again about general issues to sort of place the context of where Oregon's taxes fit in, and then respond to a couple of other things. The first thing I really want to talk about is that Oregon's budget is much, much larger than the general fund. What we're talking about today is essentially the general fund and the lottery funds, which can be spent on general purposes. Most of the budget is based on either federal expenditures that we control the administration of, matching money, like for the Medicaid system, the Oregon Health Plan, or a variety of other things. For example, the federal government pays for food stamps, but the state of Oregon administers it, and therefore that's part of this much larger budget. The other piece of the large budget is fees. And that gets me to the next thing I really want to talk about. When there are sets of things that must be done, whether you have general revenue or not, what does a state do? It raises fees. And fees come under the name of tuition. They come under the name of building permits. They come under the name of 100 other things, licensing fees for professions, on and on and on and on. Now, before 1990, before Measure 5 passed, Measure 5, which had a significant impact on property taxes, the effect of that, and I'm going to talk about this balloon, a little different balloon than the one that Vicky was talking about, but the balloon of how you manage in a situation with revenues being down. When the property tax was cut, school funding was clobbered, along with all local governments. At that time, Eugene School District, and I think Springfield too, had about somewhere between 75 and 90% of their budget actually came from local property taxes. Now, it's in the range of 25 to 40%, and it varies from year to year. The rest of the money is made up from the state general fund. So the state general fund contribution towards schools in 1990 was a fairly small percentage of the total. Now, education gobbles up most of the general fund, if you include the universities and community colleges and some other educational things. The biggest chunk of it goes to K-12. And what did the state do in order to compensate for that? This is the balloon. It took money out of every other general fund account to pay toward schools, and it was still unable to make up the difference. So our local schools were cut significantly almost immediately in 1993, which is the impetus for me to run for the school board, which ended up from my impetus to run, as Dave pointed out, for the legislature later. And it was because 100 Eugene School District teachers were laid off in 1993, and I got angry about that, and we still have not replaced those funds. The legislature did a yeoman's work trying to figure out how to do it. They sent to us a ballot measure which would do the thing that Dave said we can't do. It would have set up a sales tax in 1993. I'll take full credit for the fact that Lane County got 10% more votes on that sales tax than the state did as a whole. In Lane, it was 36%. In the state at the whole, it was 26%. And so Dave is absolutely correct. There's no way we're going to pass a sales tax. Forget about it. It ain't happening. But the result of that was that the legislature took money out of everything else. And so that meant that tuition at the university went up, community college tuition went up. They ended up cutting in a whole variety of ways. University of Oregon, before this, got half of its education budget from the general fund. Now, it's about 10% of its education budget, 5% of the total budget from the general fund. And so it's basically tuition dependent and dependent upon gifts from alumni and others in order to keep operating. And that is true for everything else. Anybody bought a building permit lately? Not in this room, apparently. Yeah, there's a couple.
Or a car.
Anybody buy a car lately? I mean, all of these fees and taxes that have gone up on these other things have come about precisely because the general fund money, either from the city and county, are no longer there because they had to cut their budget, or from the state is no longer there, and therefore you have to pay for it personally. And so our fee budget is extremely high. That's probably enough on that. So if you're able to increase the general fund budget, You can backfill the education budget, which of course is our first priority, and you can maybe start putting some general fund dollars back into these other things. If you buy a building permit, just give one quick example. If you buy a building permit, much of that is to make sure that your whatever you're building gets built correctly, so that you can use it for the purpose that you intended to use it, and it's safe, right? Well, but part of the benefit of that is to the general public. It reduces fire costs. It increases the likelihood that there will not be pollution on the streets because you're properly connected to the sewer, and a whole variety of other things. That part of those costs ought to be borne by the general fund, either the city or the county or the state, and right now it's not. A couple of other quick comments about other taxes. The legislature passed a big bill in 2017 on transportation. It started out as being something that was going to be just an increase in the gas tax in order to fill the potholes and replace the bridges that are going to fall down in the earthquake. And it got to be much bigger than that. So now you pay a 0.1% payroll tax, employee payroll tax, to help pay for transit. The object there is to reduce the number of cars on the road. If you insist on driving, you will benefit because there will be fewer people in front of you on the road during rush hour. Other people who would just as soon ride the bus will benefit because there'll be more bus out there for them to use. Rural parts of the state will benefit greatly because now there are some places you can't get around on the bus. Other things that were done include things that will allow us to move more quickly to conversion to electric vehicles, which helps us deal with climate change and a variety of other things on those taxes. Finally, I'll simply note that because of these supermajority requirements that Dave referred to, it is very difficult to increase taxes like the tobacco tax. California and Washington both have much higher tobacco taxes than we have. Why should tobacco taxes go up? Well, there's two reasons. Healthcare costs for smokers is about $9 a pack. Our tax is a small fraction of that. So everyone else is subsidizing smokers when it comes to healthcare. The other reason is that when you raise the price of tobacco products, you reduce the number of 13-year-olds who can afford to buy them. And that is a great benefit because it reduces addiction rates later. We also make money from liquor markups, which the governor's proposed an increase in. And we make money from estate taxes, where a transfer of estates from one generation to the next is taxed if that transfer is more than $1 million, and a variety of other things. Let me simply close by saying I think Dave is exactly right on. If we're going to raise any significant revenue in this legislature, it's going to be in the area where the polling tells us generally that Oregonians think there's a way of getting there, and that and in a fair way, and that is to deal with the large out-of-state or international businesses that actually pay far, far smaller, lower taxes in Oregon than in other places. And a final comment about that. Oregon, your dollars, when you buy things from these big out-of-state businesses, that won't show up on the radio, but it will show up on TV, perhaps. When you buy those things, you're helping to support the taxes paid in other states by the big corporation that makes and sells them. If we actually tax them at the same general amount that they pay in other states, Oregon would stop subsidizing those taxes and start using the tax money in Oregon to help pay for things that Oregonians need. And I'm going to stop there, and we'll go to questions.
Is this on?
You may have to turn that on.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. This has been, you know, when I told people I was going to this city club about taxes, there was like, okay. But this is, I mean, this is interesting. And I think, you know, it's really good for us to learn more about how our state taxes work. And so I appreciate it. I'm Rachel McDonald with KLCC. I was given some questions to ask you. Some of them I feel like you have already addressed, but I'll go through them, and I might skip around a little bit. The first one is about interest groups that determine tax policies in Oregon. What are those interest groups? And you can, whoever wants to answer this can start off, and folks want to chime in.
I frankly think a lot of times we give too much credibility to interest groups saying, well, that interest group is going to oppose this, so we can't do that. I can give you, and I think all three of us can give you, a variety of examples where the legislature has stepped up on an issue where the overwhelming presence in the building in terms of lobbyists on one side of an issue was against what we did. And So I think where there are definitely, I mean, when you talk to corporate, let's take corporate taxes as an example. There are lots of different business groups. There are a lot of small business groups that I think are in an interesting spot because they are already paying their fair share or more because large corporations are paying less. They actually have an opportunity to be more engaged. They aren't that strongly represented in the Capitol in terms of a voice. I think it's fair to say large corporations have many voices in and around the Capitol. And for a lot of years, that's been very successful in stopping potential corporate tax return or in slowing it. I've got to say, Phil and I talked about those rooms of negotiation leading up to what became Measure 66 and 67. There were many, many, many meetings with different combinations of business groups. And in just about every meeting, the folks on the other side would say, representing the business groups would say, we're willing to support corporate taxes. And yet, as we'd come back with proposal after proposal after proposal, modeling after different states, even taking their advice and incorporating, I mean, the gross receipts corporate minimum model was not Phil and my preference. It was a business group that suggested we use gross receipts, gross organ sales, as the model for that. But even at the end of that process of incorporating their ideas and downsizing the proposal, none of those business groups could still get there to support. Some got to neutral. But I think legislators and citizens just need to engage and pursue, still staying within what is possible, but not worrying about if some loud editorial board or some loud interest group happens to be opposed.
My Republicanism is coming out. How many corporations do you think there are in the state of Oregon? How many are making money in the state of Oregon? I think corporations and corporate taxes, in the public's eye, you mean business, not corporations. Because the truth of the matter is, there are 13,000 multi-state corporations registered in the state of Oregon. If you soak those 13,000, oh, and they aren't necessarily making a lot of money in the state of Oregon, okay? The Oregon-only ones, 14,000, and most of them, over half, aren't making any money. So just soaking corporations is not really viable. So what we're talking about is business taxes. Some way of, in my mind, this is how I visualize them, they're really an upstream sales tax. And I'm sorry, this is what I'm famous for. Getting down to it. That's what it is. If you impose these business taxes, and that's what Washington does in spades, you have to be very careful and very strategic, or they cascade down to you and really hurt your economy. So I think that's what we're looking at, because Dave's exactly right. Sales tax a non-starter, and we've managed to use this demon corporation word. I mean, I call it the Walmart tax. Oh, hell, I'm happy to tax Walmart. But we're a small state. We don't have a lot of Walmarts. And so what we're really talking is something in the business sector, some tax schemes, and there's lots of them out there, and they're really complicated, and I don't think we have time to get into them all. But in answer to, I want to pivot back to our original question. Who are the interest groups? The voters. Where tax issues matter, Dave is exactly right. The voters speak all the time. It's very easy to refer things back to the voters, and when you're sitting in the committee and you're hearing these proposals, you're saying, how am I going to explain this back to the voters when some interest group, and it doesn't take very much money, splashes something across your TV that says, Vicky Berger's raising your taxes. Call her up and tell her not to. And they don't want to know all this that you're spending an hour. They just know Vicky Berger's raising your taxes, and I don't want her to. It's a very simple thing to get to. So ultimately, when those of us are sitting in a committee talking about taxes, we're hearing, you know, this business group doesn't like this, and this group doesn't like that, and this group doesn't like that. But in the background, what you're hearing is, and Dave hit it right on, what are the voters going to think? Because, boy, do they weigh in on this issue in a major way.
Thank you. You know, I agree with both Dave and Vicky. And the question is which part of the elephant are you looking at? You know the old story about the trunk versus the legs versus the tail. And it's still the same elephant. When you talk about the interest groups, there are interest groups inside the legislature that are constantly working. Every single industry sector has its own lobbyists some lobbyists represent several different of the sectors. And they are not at all bashful about coming in and telling you what's wrong with the proposal that would end up in them spending more money on Oregon taxes. And sometimes they have to get very creative about it, and sometimes they don't, because sometimes they're right. Let me give you just an example of how this issue works out, and especially in response to what Vicky just said about this being somehow a backwards consumption tax. When you look at Measure 97, which failed, I think it got 43%, 44% of the vote, which is a lot better than a sales tax. When you look at that measure, one of the effects of that measure was that it was going to tax high-volume, low-margin businesses. We're talking about grocery stores, the Walmart that she referred to. That was a mistake, and because it was a generally written proposal that would have been a gross receipts tax on pretty much every corporation. The measure would have raised about $6 billion. We needed about four. We still need about four in addition to what we've got now, even though the governor's budget asks for two. It would have been possible to fix that measure by simply leaving out the high-volume, low-margin businesses, again, mostly grocery stores, and still gotten to the result that would have raised a great deal of money. Now, just to complete the circle, what I was trying to say a few minutes ago was that when you deal with businesses that have general pricing strategies, nationwide pricing strategies, Oregon's increase of the tax on them, unless it's gigantic, and it won't be, it can't be, very small, will have no effect on the price they charge Oregonians, because that tax will be spread as part of their expenses across the entire country. We pay now the higher tax that other states levy on those businesses through their national pricing strategy. If the price was to go up as a result of a very small increase in Oregon's taxes, it would go up nationwide, and it would be a rounding error on the price. It would be far less than the difference between the regular retail price and the sale price when you buy it being smart. So it's a matter of setting this thing up in a way that actually gets at the businesses that are taking advantage of Oregon's very low tax situation in order to make that to happen. Now, those businesses will tell us that raising those taxes is the most horrible and awful thing in the world that we could possibly do, so that's a part of the interest groups. Finally, let me follow up on the other comment about how taxes get done. Any significant tax that has any opposition at all is going to go to the voters. If the legislature passes it on a bill, and the governor signs the bill, it will still go to a vote of the people, because it will be referred through a referendum process, which takes very few signatures. I mean, you saw what happened with Measure 101, that was the most benign possible way of raising the matching money for the Oregon health plan, and that still went to the voters, and you still had to vote on it in January, and thank you so much for passing it, because it made a huge difference. But every single really important tax measure that has any opposition is going to go to the voters anyway. That being the case, you do not need a supermajority requirement to pass taxes in order to avoid beating up on the voter or the taxpayer, because that measure is going to go to the voters for their consideration anyway. There's a whole variety of other things that fit into that category, and I'm sorry, I'm wandering way beyond the question that was asked. But let's go on to the next one.
Well, let's follow up on 97. What if Measure 97 had been specifically dedicated to education, do you think it would have had a better chance of passing?
That would be a yes. Yes.
I think we all agree that one of the arguments that was made on Measure 97 was that you're giving all this money to the legislature, and they can spend it any old way they want. And you think of I'm not going to say them out loud, but any number of the imaginations of possible no voters. The fact is, the money would have been spent on education anyway, so dedicating it to education would have been fine.
And following up on the supermajority, speaking as a Republican member in a in a state that is at this point completely dominated. I mean, elections matter. They don't even need a supermajority. I would be down there totally irrelevant without supermajorities. Okay, so I unlike my colleagues here, I want to keep them because otherwise there's no place at the table. Nobody has to. I was one of those moderate Republicans. I was the gate they had to go through for these things, and it at least made me relevant. So I am a proponent of the supermajorities.
So let me give one counterpoint to Vicky's last comment. So when we did last have a supermajority in 2009, and we put together a group to negotiate a transportation package, we could have passed a transportation package with the Democrats, but actually we took the approach, and Vicky was at the table in lots of painful meetings in my office week after week after week, where we negotiated a transportation package that lost Democratic votes off the far left because it built new lane miles, and it lost Republican votes off the far right because it raised new taxes and fees. So even though we had a supermajority, you were still relevant in that context. The one other thing, following up on what Phil just said, or actually really following up on the question, because 97, almost by definition, because it was an initiative, it would have violated the multi-subject rule if it really both raised the taxes and carefully dedicated them to specific services. So they had some restrictions, which is why, going back to my earlier comment, I think it's got to be successful, it must come from the legislature, because things the legislature writes, whether they're referred out directly or whether they go through the referenda process, they can be multi-subject. So they can both raise taxes in multiple subject ways and dedicate those dollars. And so you don't have the same restrictions that 97 did, in part because it was an initiative.
Yeah. Dave gave the great example of the transportation measure. I'll simply add that the transportation measure in 2017 could not have been passed without Republican votes. In fact, one of the great proponents of that measure was the then state representative from District 60. The district that's the size of Connecticut and Rhode Island put together and headquartered in the other time zone in the Far East in Ontario, he was a strong proponent of the measure because it not only provided for things that the urban areas of the state needed, but also for things that the rural parts of the state needed. And that measure was not referred because the big interest groups, the people who really cared about the transportation package, all ended up supporting it. Some of them in grumblingly, but they all ended up supporting it, and nobody referred it, and it went into effect without referral. That's why I used that qualifier. Measures that have any significant opposition are all referred. This one did not, and the reason it didn't is because the Republicans were at the table. They were involved in the conversation. They got big chunks of what they wanted, and everybody had to grumble a little bit to vote for the bill. There were parts of that bill I didn't like at all. I voted for it.
Why did Oregon implement a kicker, and why does it continue?
Shall I?
Let me explain a thing or two about the kicker. It was part of, taxpayer reaction to expanding taxes, and taxpayers react. Okay, they do that, and it was seen as you'd come in and they'd fix the budget and then have more money to spend and just spend it. So this was a break on that. And basically, in case you don't remember, what the kicker says, that we have a forecasted budget, and if it comes up over 2% of that forecast, which is done 2 years before, then all of that down to the budget level goes into the kicker, not above the 2%, okay? Which is a little bit crazy in terms of policy. But here's the big thing you need to know about. It's constitutional. They did it, and then voters were still mad enough. Somebody referred it to the ballot, and it is in our Constitution. So you can go back there to legislature and say you ought to get rid of that, But there are some constitutional issues around that. And it is not good policy. It's not something the legislature would have come up with because it makes no sense. But it does act as a brake on the ballooning in good times. It isn't something you can depend on as a taxing source if you grab it and say, oh, well, which we did, by the way. The corporate section, it was originally two kickers, personal income and corporate. We threw that corporate and put it right in that rainy day fund, and that's one of the growth factors in that rainy day fund. And there's plenty of impetus to put the personal kicker in the rainy day fund. But remember, this is a growth on government thing that is popular and constitutional. So you will be weighing in on this puppy, I think.
Yeah, let me just add a couple of things to that point. This thing was first put in as a statute by a Democratic legislature in the late 80s as a result of the overage that came about as a result of the surtax that was approved in, I think, 83 after one of the recessions that was supported by Governor Attia. That was a statute. It wasn't a constitutional provision. I think it was 2000 that the constitutional provision was adopted, and my recollection is that it was referred by the Republican legislature in 1999. I may be wrong about that, but I think that's what happened. Now, here's the thing about the kicker that I think most people do not know, and they need to know. The money that comes out of the general fund to pay a kicker is paid out proportionally to the income taxes that were paid in the first place. Because we have a progressive tax system, the people who get the money are people who are very well off.
Who paid the money?
They paid the money, and they're very well off. And you can see the difference between the Republican and the Democratic argument.
Of course they paid it.
But the voters, when voters are thinking about what should we do in the future about this money, need to understand that the vast majority of them, the voters, get coffee money for a couple of days out of a kicker refund or a kicker reduction in their income tax as we do it now. The big dollars go to people who pay large taxes and who get large kicker refunds, $40,000, $80,000, $100,000. If you pay large amounts of money, you could easily get that kind of a return. That money does not actually end up being stimulative of our economy. By the way, we almost always have a kicker just before a recession, right?
And it's kicking.
That's the way, and we're having a kicker this year, which is why we're talking about this. So the money comes out. Where do the rich people put their money? They don't spend it. They don't spend it in Oregon. It goes into the New York Stock Exchange or they buy real estate or something else with it. It isn't spent in the economy and growing jobs. So it is not stimulative in the normal sense. On the other hand, if that money went into a rainy day fund, if we took the same kicker dollars and didn't change anything about what the rule is, except instead of refunding it to mostly wealthy people, you put it in a rainy day fund instead, now all of a sudden you have money to help pay for it, that recession, which usually follows a kicker, a significant kicker. 2007, a kicker was over $1 billion. 2008, the Great Recession hit. 2009, we were a couple billion dollars short. And there are other examples, but I don't want to belabor the point. So if you get a measure that comes out from the legislature to move the personal kicker out of a refund and into a rainy day fund account, I would urge you to vote for it.
And I think Oregon voters have actually moved on the kicker. 10 years ago, if you would ask me, I would have said I don't see a way to get Oregon voters to redirect the personal kicker into a rainy day fund. I've changed my perception on that now, in large part because I think public opinion polling has demonstrated that voters are more open to it, especially if it is in the rainy day fund focused way, which again takes a supermajority to spend. I think there actually is a path there with voters that I don't think there was 10 years ago.
I will also tell you that when I first came in, it was raining pretty hard in 2003.
Yep.
And there was a plan floated at that time, which I always liked, that basically had a tipping. Instead of the 2% and above, it was a tipping, the bucket plan. Remember the bucket plan? Where the kicker would go into the rainy day fund to a certain point, and then anything above that would kick back. So it fed the rainy day fund. There were buckets, depending on the size of the kicker, instead of this automatic 2% and above going back, which I always like that bucket plan. It may come back.
If audience members have questions, I'd encourage you to bring them to me, and hopefully we can fit some audience questions in. We talked a little bit about the initiative process and what is the relatively easy initiative process in Oregon. Does that make it? It seems like this is going to be a yes, but does that make changing taxes more difficult? And with these constitutional amendments, I'm wondering: do you feel like voters should be leery of an initiative that says something about this changes the Constitution, which quite often we see in initiatives?
And I do think voters are increasingly leery. I must confess, I was pleasantly surprised with voters' response to Measure 103 and 104 on the 2018 ballot. I would have instinctively thought that something that appears to cap taxes, in both cases, voters said, no, we don't want that language in our Constitution because it's too restrictive and it'll have unintended consequences. I think voters were absolutely right. I'm pleasantly surprised that that was their conclusion. And they didn't really end up being that close. So the results on 103 and 104 give me hope that voters are more skeptical. Well, and also the fact that they pulled the double majority out of the Constitution in 2008. I mean, I think there are signs that voters have been increasingly skeptical about constitutional changes that tie hands. So I think the initiative process still is challenging, but it's not insurmountable.
I would concur, but I would also add that I would not go to the next step and say, but we trust the legislature.
The Oregon plan, adopted, I think, in 1905, included initiative, referendum, and recall. I think Oregon was the first state to adopt these rules. We've had them ever since. When voters are knowledgeable or paying attention, are looking at who is paying the cost of the television ads and other things that are related to a measure, when those things are the case, I think we do pretty well. When you have a situation in which there's a stampede and decisions get made based on poor facts, you end up with Measures 5 and Measures 50, which have made a horrendous mess out of our property tax system. I will tell you that when the Revenue Committee meets to talk about property taxes and listen to experts describe how they work, they all go away with an Excedrin headache, because it is almost impossible for people who are not tax experts to actually understand it, let alone respond to it. And as a result of Measures 5 and 50, we have the crazy situation that two houses next door to each other, built by the same contractor on mirror plans, you know, they look alike except the paint's different, pay very different property taxes based on the way the history of that particular house happened. Pretty soon, we have got to get to the place where we can have another constitutional amendment and fix Measures 5 and 50. It gets worse every year. The disparities, the unfairness, the craziness of the application of those two rules get worse every year, and it's going to have to be fixed. I don't know how to do it. We tried every year I was chair of the committee to figure it out, and we were not successful.
So, let's see here. Dave said taxes need to show specific targets. I think we do a poor job of showing our taxpayers what they get for their taxes. We all seem to think stuff costs less than it actually does. How can we improve that?
I'll start. State government, in terms of reporting to the voters or to the citizens, is about at the level where auto insurance was in 1980, when you got an auto insurance policy that was unreadable, that was based on crazy common law cases decided in England in 1867, and therefore had archaic language in it. Auto insurance policies have improved so that it's actually possible for a person with ordinary intelligence to be able to read the thing and understand what it means. Go home and look at yours, you'll see what I mean. It is not easy, but it's possible. Right now, in Oregon, you can get online, you can read our basic facts document that is published every year by the Legislative Revenue Office by going to www.oregonlegislature.gov and then going to website that includes the Legislative Revenue Office, and then going to their publications, and then you'll find this document. Now, here's the problem. It's 1980. It is a great document for wonks like the three of us. It's wonderful because it has everything in it. It's also 110 pages long. We need to do a better job of actually writing these things in language that can be understood. Now, I will say, if you go to the governor's budget, which is online, which you can get at Oregon.gov, and you go to it early on, pages. Let's see. Here's that book. It's even worse if you look at the whole thing. But there is a great summary of where the money comes from and where it goes on page 11. On page 11, it's a great summary that describes it all. So we're starting to get there, but we don't have a Department of Communications with the Public. We don't have one of those. I think that we need them in order for ordinary folks to understand what we do with their money. And I don't think that's just the state. I think it's county, city, and other governments as well.
Can I underline that? People say, well, why didn't you tell me? Well, you're here and we're telling you. I want you to know that I am so happily retired from everything. But because somebody called me and said, will you come and talk taxes? If I can get in front of an audience and talk taxes, I'm just ecstatic because you're here and you're interested. Go home and talk to your friends and say, you know, you need to tune into these constitutional issues. That's all I want you to do, because we have no arm of that as policymakers. We just simply don't.
So we are pretty much at the times, and I can fit in a couple more questions. So taxes on other people will never fill all the gaps. If we only go after easy targets, how will we ever balance the budget? And how can we talk about a rainy day fund with the black hole of PERS looming?
Yeah. Who wants to talk?
Well, I think, don't tax me, don't tax thee, tax the guy behind the tree. There is truth. Oregonians, that probably is about where they're coming from. The good news is, I think there, and Phil intimated some of this earlier, there are some opportunities, not in so much in property taxes or personal income tax or sales taxes, but when you look at, especially some of the multinational corporations that are doing business in Oregon, there is some element of the guy behind the tree there. Not all of it, but there is some element there. And so whether it's looking at tweaking the corporate minimum tax, either the rate of the corporate minimum tax or the cap that we put on the corporate minimum tax, whether it is looking at a business activity or value-added tax, or perhaps even looking at issues around complete reporting by multinational corporations, that will provide a clear sense, because there are some of those corporations that are doing business in Oregon, earning profits in Oregon, and putting those profits into the part of those multinational corporations that is not, it's physically in the United States. So there are some opportunities to tax the person behind the tree, but part of it is just acknowledging that if we really want good schools, if we want reasonable tuition, if we want adequate class sizes, if we want to invest in career technical education, if we want to invest in public services that we all value, then we are going to have to ask some folks to pay a little bit more. And I think being guided by where voters sense there is capacity for some people to pay a little bit more, which is on the corporate side, not on the personal side, I think is therefore where we need to be led. Oh, and in terms of PERS, I've got to say, in terms of PERS, I consider it very much like, Tanya and I have a mortgage on our house. We agreed to that mortgage. I can't just unilaterally say, well, I want to keep living in the house, but I'm going to stop paying my mortgage because I think it's too high. When you have contractual agreements that the Supreme Court, Oregon Supreme Court, has repeatedly said we have to honor, I think it's not a great situation. People that were in the legislature long before us made some horrible decisions. Actually, decisions made in the legislature during the tenure that we were there have actually created what's basically a tier three OPSERP that is very sustainable. But I would be the first to acknowledge tier one and even tier two are not sustainable. And I don't know what math was being used back then to come up with those projections. But those are contractual agreements as much as my mortgage is a contractual agreement, and I don't see how we walk away. I do think we can focus on paying down the PERS debt. It's, if you look at the long-term charts, it's a one-time huge bubble in the system that once people like my mother-in-law pass away, she was thinking that, so I just articulated it. Once those tier one retirees, and if you look her up on the chart, she's not very high because she taught her whole career in Marcola. But it is a cyclical thing. It doesn't go on forever because we're not accumulating these kind of debts for folks who have come into the system since 2003. It's folks who came in 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah. Let me just second that. The PERS issue is a great political device to beat up on state government, and people are going to continue using it. What you need to know is that the debt was incurred. It has to be paid. There are some very minor things that could still be done that would make a very, very tiny difference. But the great heroes of this issue are people like Tony Corcoran, who was a senator, Oregon senator at the time in 2003, and Greg McPherson, who was a member of the House in 2003, both Democrats during the time of Republican control. They were able to get the bills passed in 2003 that Dave refers to, and they are the ones that actually cut off the loss. That's done. What we're doing now is paying the mortgage, and I really like that metaphor. And so when you hear somebody say, gee, we got to do something about PERS, what you know is they either don't understand PERS or they're using it as a rhetorical point in order to gain votes. And in either case, you probably don't want to support them. Now, what was the other piece of the question?
I think that was just how do we balance the budget?
The balancing the budget is going to be a huge effort, and it's a huge effort every year. And part of it is because of the ramping in of that long-term PERS payment. When people in my generation die, that PERS payment goes away. It's gone because the fix that happened in 2003 takes care of it. That's what Dave was trying to say a minute ago. The fix for the budget is an ongoing effort that has to be done. Several reasons. PERS is one of them. The other is that the state population continues to go up. There was one year, I think 2003, in which we did not get an increase in population in Oregon. We've had one before that and since that, every year for nearly forever. I think 1847 may have been the other year it didn't go up. So that's another piece. The value of the dollar continues to decline, and so services cost more denominated in dollars every year, and on and on. If you really want to deal with the PERS question quickly and easily, pray for a Trump inflation. Now, I think inflation is a terrible, ghastly problem, but it would very quickly get rid of the PERS debt by essentially bankrupting PERS recipients because the value of the dollar would go way down. But that's the way you do it. And I'm probably being blunter than I should about this, but I find it extremely irritating that an issue which needed to be dealt with in the 90s if it was going to be fixed, and wasn't dealt with until 2003, keeps being brought up as an object to be kicked in order to promote some political position. We just have to figure out how we're going to manage these budgets and struggle on through. Vicky's going to tell us how you can fix PERS.
No, I'm not.
No, good.
I'm going to affirm for you, when something south of 20% of what you're paying in taxes is going to a pension obligation, not to services, you should be angry. Mm-hmm. Now, how it happened and who did it, we can yell about that all the same. Yep. But you can't. You are legitimately, I'm unhappy, they're unhappy, when you're paying taxes into a system and that money you know is not going to this classroom, it's going to a retirement. And I have no complaint with retirees. My husband is a PERS retiree, okay? But that's the basic, that's why this PERS thing keeps coming up, because we're asking you to pay taxes, but you're not getting more services, and you know it because of this PERS, because of some really bad PERS decisions. And I just want to affirm that in this room. I don't have an answer for it, but to not say that it's a reality in Oregon is to deny you as taxpayers that sort of grinding acid that I get whenever it comes up.
Right. And can I just finally follow up by saying, despite what I may have sounded like I was saying a minute ago, I completely agree with that point. But I am helpless, and I think everybody who understands the issue is helpless to actually fix it, because of the box we are in, because of decisions that were made in the 1970s.
90s. Well, on that 90s. Uplifting note, did you want to make some closing remarks? And thank you so much. This has been really interesting, and certainly, if folks have more questions, I think the speakers will stick around for a little bit. So, thank you so much.
Thank you all for coming. I guess none of you is going to wish me long life in the future at this point. But I just want to thank the speakers for what I think was probably the most exciting and most interesting program we have had at Springfield City Club in a long, long time.
And it's about taxes.
That's what makes it even more exciting. In the next 72 or 96 hours, we will have this available on the Springfield City Club Facebook page. If you want to refer all of your friends who get a chance to listen to a brilliant hour and a quarter discussion of the most arcane subject you could ever imagine. Thank you all for coming, and I hope to see you again soon. And don't forget Eugene City Club tomorrow.